Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And as most of you probably could have guessed, we also have a very important champagne toast to the late Barbara Bush at the end of today's podcast. We want to let you know we are all sponsored today by Wink. Discover great wine today. Go to trywink.com/martini and get $20 off your first shipment. trywink.com/martini. Jim, let's start with our good martini. And Jim, we start with Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley, of course, is the former South Carolina governor who is now the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And on several occasions, we've had very good things to say about how she has clearly and boldly stated U.S. positions on a number of important international topics. But this week, she's been mixing it up with members of the Trump administration, and in particular, the president's new chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow. In the wake of the strike on Syria, Nikki Haley went on Face the Nation on Sunday, making a big announcement about new sanctions. Larry Kudlow then suggested that that wasn't the case, and Nikki Haley got a bit confused, and that did not sit well. Brian Williams, of all people, at NBC, has a pretty good blow-by-blow on this, and here's how it played out for Nikki Haley and Larry Kudlow this week.
Russian sanctions will be coming down. Secretary Mnuchin will be announcing those on Monday, if he hasn't already. And they will go directly to any sort of companies that were dealing with equipment related to Assad and chemical weapons use.
On Monday, White House officials said Trump had not yet decided on those sanctions. Then earlier today, Chief White House Economic Advisor Larry Kudlow told reporters, quote, "She got ahead of the curve. She's done a great job. She's a very effective ambassador, but there might have been some momentary confusion." Well, that turned out to be a mistake. Nikki Haley fired right back, telling Fox News, quote, "With all due respect, I don't get confused." And now Larry Kudlow has apologized to Nikki Haley, telling the New York Times, quote, "She was certainly not confused. I was wrong to say that, totally wrong. As it turns out, she was basically following what she thought was policy. The policy has changed, and she wasn't told about it, so she was in a box."
Jim, summing this one up, caution. Trying to throw Nikki Haley under the bus will result in severe damage to the bus.
Yeah. The other way I was thinking about it is that, trying to contradict Nikki Haley after she's declared something is going to happen is kind of like trying to get out of the parking garage. You can back up, but you're going to get some severe tire damage in the process. She's like those hard spikes that only go down in one direction. Look, it's not that hard to figure out what's happened here. This is a president whose mind can be changed very quickly, who will contradict himself in a matter of a couple hours, and is very often influenced by the last person he speaks to. And if you think that I'm being, nasty old Jim is picking on Trump again, I'd point you to his meeting on immigration, where he basically agreed with everything Dianne Feinstein wanted on that, or the time the White House negotiations, where he openly on camera said that he approved the assault weapons ban and had to walk that back. He's thinking about changing his mind on TPP, the Trade Promotion Authority. We were going to completely withdraw from Syria, and that was about a week before the airstrikes. Right? I mean, depending on who Trump talks to, or what he sees on TV that day, or even, I think, considerably his mood, can very much change how he feels about any particular decision in front of him. And something happened that made him not want to go ahead with these sanctions on Russian companies for helping Syria. Now, it's the president's prerogative to change his mind, but we should be honest about the fact that the president has changed his mind. We should not pretend we have always been at war with East Asia or Eurasia, as they say, in 1984. And very often when the president, when the principal makes a decision that could make them look bad, many times, yes, it is the job of the staff to jump on the grenade, so to speak, and say, "Oh, no, I was mistaken. The president's policy was not Y, it was X." I think Nikki Haley's had enough of this. And she's, if the president wants to change his mind after she's announced these sanctions will be forthcoming, that's fine. But the president and the White House should explain why the president changed his mind. They shouldn't come out and say, "Oh, Nikki Haley got confused," or "Nikki Haley didn't know what she was talking about." The latest phrase I keep hearing a lot of in Washington the last couple of months, Greg, is getting out in front of their skis. I don't know if this is a Winter Olympics thing or something like that, but it's this weird sense of this person was looking ahead too far. assumed a decision has been made or was official that wasn't quite official or something like that. And I think Nikki Haley just isn't, you know, you can play that with certain other cabinet officials, but she's not taking it. And when we were just, you know, we discussed this on CNN yesterday, there was this observation, Nikki Haley isn't kind of the person who does this. Somebody like, oh, Ben Carson does it. Okay, that's just Ben Carson being Ben Carson. My understanding, particularly when she goes and does an appearance on the Sunday shows, she checks and talks with Trump fairly regularly for a UN ambassador. With the lack of a Secretary of State, she is effectively, if not the most preeminent voice, then one of the most preeminent voices of this White House in the realm of foreign policy, is generally much on top of these things, does her homework and communication with lots of other people in the White House. You don't go in the Sunday shows and not know what policies are coming out. You don't announce something by accident or something like that. She is, you know, as I understand it, somebody who dots her I's and crosses her T's and isn't going to just make a clumsy mistake like that or something like that. So I give her some kudos, and maybe it's time to stop indulging the president's erratic sudden changes in position and things like that, and to say, look, if you say the policy is going to be X, then you have to go out and enact the policy of X. You can't suddenly watch the news coverage and say, oh, wait a second, I want to change it back to Y today.
Has anybody's stock in this administration gone up like Nikki Haley's over the past year and change? I mean, between her extremely clear and strong statements, which I assume are reflecting administration policy, but when it comes to North Korea or Syria or whatever it is, or her tough but not annoying style and even willing to stand up to her own boss here, she is doing an impressive job.
If the rumors are true, at one point, Trump offered her Secretary of State, and she said she did not feel like that would be a good fit. She'd been a good and successful governor of South Carolina, but that's not a job that traditionally prepares you that much to handle foreign policy. Although, considering how Rex Tillerson turned out, maybe she would have been a better choice. But she, you know, she expressed interest in the position of being ambassador to the United Nations, which, oh, by the way, would be good foreign policy experience if someday Nikki Haley wanted to run for president. I don't know if she does, but she certainly does seem to be accumulating a varied resume, and she, you know, has done her job and has not contradicted the boss, and has in fact, I think, generally, I'd argue, enhanced the message of the boss and brought an eloquence and a firmness to it that is exactly what the Trump administration needed. So yes, I think she's basically been the all-star of the administration up to this point. And you know what? I mean, one of the things that she does so well compared to all of her cabinet other members of the Trump cabinet, Greg, you know what that is?
What?
She's still in the job.
Her and Mad Dog, that they're about the only ones that that seem to have the same stock or perhaps even a higher stock than when they began. So Nikki Haley is a great example of a governor who is moving on to bigger and better things. And there are other governors who might be moving on, but not to bigger and better things. Let's go to our bad martini. This is courtesy of CBS News. Missouri Governor Eric Greitens repeated Tuesday that he will not resign, despite several prominent members of his own party asking him to step down. That would be the legislative leaders of his own party, and a resolution filed to authorize articles of impeachment against him. A report by a Missouri House investigatory committee last week accused Greitens of initiating a physically aggressive, unwanted sexual encounter with his hairdresser and threatened to distribute a partially nude photo of her if she spoke out against it. Here's his tweet. I will not be resigning the governor's office. In 3 weeks, this matter will go to a court of law where it belongs and where the facts will prove my innocence, he said Tuesday. Until then, I will do what the people of Missouri sent me here to do, to serve them and work hard on their behalf. Greitens, 44, faces a felony invasion of privacy indictment in St. Louis. Greitens has admitted to the 2015 affair but insisted the sex was consensual. Separately, Republican Attorney General Josh Hawley suggested Tuesday the St. Louis prosecutor could bring another felony charge against Greitens for allegedly taking the donor list from a veterans charity he founded and using it to raise money for his gubernatorial campaign. Hawley said his office has turned over the evidence to the St. Louis Circuit Attorney's Office and the House Committee investigating Greitens, according to CBS affiliate KMOV. Greitens says this is big nothing burger as well, saying fortunately for Josh, he's better at press conferences than the law. Then he tried to tie him to George Soros and a whole bunch of other things. So, Jim, it's time for Eric Greitens to go, and he just won't go.
Yeah, I don't want to put this all at the feet of Bill Clinton. Greitens got himself in trouble, but I can't help but get the feeling we're seeing yet another exhibition of the Bill Clinton playbook from 1998. And we've seen it from a lot of lawmakers and a lot of politicians over the years. I think obviously Trump is a pretty good example of a person who has been accused of terrible scandals and basically just decides he's going to weather the storms. He's going to ignore it. He's going to counterattack. He's going to deny everything. And he's just going to remain until he's removed from office. And I think you can look at that. I think of Greg, who is the California congressman who was involved with Chandra Levy?
Gary Condit.
Gary Condit. There you go. There was this change that basically, I don't think it's too outrageous to say that before 1998, when a politician was caught in a really embarrassing sex scandal, and I say, Greitens has admitted the affair. He just says that it was not non-consensual, that it was not terribly physically aggressive, et cetera, that traditionally that would be, okay, you got to step down, that you've embarrassed your party, you've embarrassed everyone who supported you. It's time for you to quietly step into the private sector. And politicians don't feel they have to do that anymore. We've seen this on both parties, and there used to be a sense of, okay, the opposition party, they're always going to be calling. They always want scalps. They always want somebody to go. But when people in your own party, when your traditional political allies, friends are embarrassed by you, when your friends cannot believe what you've done, they find the accusations credible, and they do not believe that you belong in office any longer. Well, then it was time to go. Then it was, you know, that there wasn't this automatic, we got to support our guys. We got to rally around our guy and defend him no matter what he's done, because otherwise, no matter what happens, we can't let the other side get the win. So kudos to at least some Missouri Republicans are saying, look, this is just unacceptable behavior in a governor. This is not his birthright. You're not royalty. We can find another conservative Republican governor, pal. You got to go. And it's depressing that he's going to apparently drag this out, and it's going to, you know, fight to the last man. He can't simply accept the fact that he's done something that is unacceptable. And, you know, people on both sides of the aisle have said, you know what, we need a fresh start here in Missouri. It's a difficult enough political environment for Republicans now. They have a governor who's got to decide that if he just waits long enough, I guess he thinks people are going to forget about this or something like that.
Perhaps we'll see. And you're right that already the Democrats are going to try to paint every Republican as being joined at the hip with President Trump. And now in Missouri, assuming Greitens doesn't go, they'll try to at least paint some Republicans there as sticking with Greitens, even though a lot of Republicans, it would appear, are not in favor of him sticking around anymore. And, oh, by the way, the attorney general, who is looking at this campaign felony with using the charity donor list as a political fundraiser, Josh Hawley, he is most likely going to be the Republican candidate against Claire McCaskill. So this may insulate him to a great extent against any sort of ongoing affiliation with Greitens. But Josh Hawley doing the job he was elected to do, Jim, regardless of which party it might impact.
On the one hand, that could help. But in the end, I mean, look, do you think this makes voters in Missouri in a good mood about Republicans as they go to the or in a bad mood when they go into the ballot box in November? My suspicion is the bad mood. I don't know if you'd say this is going to, you know, tank the party up and down the ticket, but you know, he's not, Greitens isn't on the ballot, but nonetheless, I think this is just not what you want your party to be dealing with as midterm elections approach.
Why is there just a dumpster fire in Republican politics every time Claire McCaskill's on the ballot? This is not fair. All right.
Dumpster arson.
So, Missouri Republicans, you could head to the liquor store, but why leave the house? With online ordering, quick shipping, and personalized recommendations, Wink is the way to make discovering wine so much easier. We've talked about Wink before. It's spelled W-I-N-C, and it makes it easy to discover great wine. And that's because Wink's wine experts select wines matched to your taste, personalized just for you, and shipped right to your door. And it all starts at just $13 a bottle.
Now, let me tell you, there is nothing like coming home to a delivery box of delicious Wink wine selected just for you. It will become the best day of your month. You just fill out Wink's palate profile quiz. You answer some simple questions that your average store clerk just isn't going to ask or can't really translate into a recommendation. Questions like, how do you take your coffee, or how do you feel about blueberries? Then Wink will send you wines that are curated to your taste based on your answers. And the more wines that you rate, the more personalized your monthly selections will become.
And each month, there are new delicious wines, like the insanely popular Summer Water Rosé. There are no membership fees. You can skip any month. You can cancel any time. Shipping is covered, and if you don't like a bottle they send you, they'll replace it with a bottle you'll love. No questions asked. And as I mentioned in the past couple of weeks, we've experienced all of this. There was one bottle of white that we thought was just a little too fruity. We told them about it, and we got the credit towards the next month's purchase. And then we realized, you know, we still got quite a bit of wine left because they sent us four bottles, all at a very reasonable rate there, starting at $13 a bottle. And so we just went online. Hey, don't send it to us in April. We're good. And no problem. And we'll just see where things stand once we get to May. So very easy to deal with. And by the way, the other wine was outstanding. The two bottles of red we got were terrific. One was a blend. We used it on Easter. Everyone loved it. And just fabulous service as well. So discover great wine today. Go to trywink.com/martini. You'll get $20 off your first shipment. That's spelled TRYWINC.com/martini for $20 off. TryWink.com/martini. All right, Jim, on to the crazy martini now. And we're going to talk a little bit about Evan McMullen, one of your favorite people. This is courtesy of the Daily Caller Investigative Unit. Former presidential candidate Evan McMullen's failed campaign ended its quixotic journey, 6 figures in debt as of summer 2017. And records show it has missed every deadline to file the required financial statements since then. The Federal Election Commission sent numerous letters to the McMullen for President Committee over the last year, warning that the organization risks fines for failing to file and for making errors on financial statements it did manage to submit. McMullen's committee was nearly $645,000 in debt just after the 2016 election, according to a financial statement the group filed to the FEC in December of that year. By July 2017, it increased to nearly $670,000, according to that month's filings. That was the last financial statement that McMullen's committee filed. Since then, the organization has missed 3 deadlines, including one that passed on Sunday. The FEC has consequently sent the group warnings that it could face penalties if it doesn't provide the necessary information. So, Jim, in a week that the world's tallest Boy Scout, Jim Comey, has been raked over the coals in a number of ways, the sanctimonious Evan McMullen is apparently not meeting his obligations either.
Greg, I thought conservatives hated deficit spending. And thought we liked the rule of law. I think FEC deadlines are law. Everybody can understand, it was in my outgoing mailbox and I forgot to put a stamp on it or something like that. But when you blow through 3 deadlines for the FEC, that's kind of an indicator something's going on. Look, Evan McMullen, strong, strong candidate for the dumbest vote I've ever made, is now going to, you know, like has, you know, reinvented himself during the campaign. He kept saying, look, I am a consistent conservative. Trump deviates from conservative philosophy in a whole lot of ways. I want to give America a choice between shouldn't have a choice between just a liberal progressive and a populist. There should be a conservative choice. And then after the election, after Trump won, Evan McMullen seemed to forget a whole lot of what he, you know, of any of the conservative stuff. And he just became the anti-Trump candidate. I mentioned this in a previous podcast and somebody corrected me. Apparently, Greg, McMullen has made 2 tweets that were praising of Justice Gorsuch. So that's the one that is the you know, minuscule chicken bone he has thrown to Trump for a good choice or a good decision since reaching office. Other than that, you look at his Twitter feed, his public appearances. It's been relentlessly negative, relentlessly anti-Trump on almost everything that he does, even when he takes the position that most conservatives would say, attaboy, Mr. President, that's what we want to see more of. And I'm just kind of left with the $600,000 in debt and everything else. Greg, I don't know about you. I have a question on my mind. Evan McMullen, what do you do for a living?
He's got some sort of outfit now that he basically uses a platform to criticize Trump.
Okay, but to quote Office Space, just what is it you'd say you do here, Eric? Because, I mean, is it just that people donate things to his organization and the organization pays for him to fly around the country and offer the original and unparalleled message that Trump is bad? Because you know, because there's no other place people can get that message, right? What are you trying to do? What's the goal here? I assume maybe someday he'd want to run for office again. Does he want to run as a Republican? He certainly seems to have renounced not just Trump, but basically anything the GOP is doing these days. He keeps, you know, hammering the rest of the GOP. He and Mindy Finn, who I've been on good terms with, but like, I don't see a heck of a lot of daylight between their messaging and the Democrats' messaging. So if you want to become a Democrat, fine, go ahead, go do it. I think they would welcome with open arms. But if you notice that the 2018, you know, primaries are assembling, a lot of competition to be an anti-Trump candidate in a Democratic primary, right? Evan McMullen, you know, in a Republican, you know, at CPAC, for example, not that he would go to this, but if he went to CPAC, Evan McMullen would be the former CIA Mormon guy who's really opposed to Trump. You know, Greg, if Evan McMullen had gone to a Democratic gathering in this year or next year, you know what they would call him?
What?
Evan. Just another guy doing the exact same messaging there. So kind of a tough day for Evan McMullen. Look, I mean, you know, maybe he'll pay down the debt. Maybe everything will be hunky dory. Maybe he'll get the maybe this story will make people his folks will get all their FEC papers in on time. Actually, this just handed to me, Greg. He has entered his 16th minute of fame.
All right. As we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, and as I'm sure just about all of you know by now, former First Lady Barbara Bush passed away on Tuesday at the age of 92. We found out on Sunday that she was foregoing care other than palliative care for congestive heart failure and COPD. So we knew this was unfortunately coming sooner rather than later. Barbara Bush, of course, occupies a very special place in American history. The wife of one president and the mother of another. Only Abigail Adams could claim the same. And Abigail Adams never lived to see her son become president. So Barbara Bush was absolutely unique in that regard. Jim, she was not necessarily known as a fashion plate. You wrote about this, not necessarily fitting the Hollywood casting image of a first lady. But she was real. Barbara Bush, as I tweeted out last night, she took her role seriously, didn't take herself seriously. And she was blunt. She was funny. She was self-deprecating. And people could relate to that when sometimes maybe her husband couldn't connect in that way. She was a passionate advocate for literacy. And as one of his speechwriters said in a recent conversation with me, without Barbara Bush, George Bush 41 never becomes president. She was kind of a little bit like Nancy Reagan in that sense, that she knew the possibilities, she knew the strengths that her husband had, and really helped to propel him in that direction. And while there will be ways to discuss the merits and the demerits of the Bush years, probably whenever his time comes, Barbara Bush was a wonderful person, probably my favorite first lady in my lifetime anyway, and she will be deeply missed.
Yeah, Greg, I've been thinking about this, that, you know, on the one hand, when you think back to her time as first lady, her time as, I guess you could say, you know, second lady, as when, you know, George H.W. Bush was vice president, on the one hand, there was always this grace, this class, this classic genteel manners and consideration. But the great irony is that at the same time, there was this also this fierceness behind it, maybe comparable to Margaret Thatcher. That everybody kind of knew that Barbara Bush stood up for her husband and for her family, and that she could be a tough lady when she wanted to be, even if she wasn't going to let it show very much. And I was, you know, one of the examples that I described in the Jolt that I think says a lot about her was that, so it's 84, they're running for re-election. The Democrats are running a ticket of Walter Mondale and Geraldine Ferraro. And the Bushes were getting grief for being wealthy and, you know, waspy and patrician and, you know, all of that. And somebody had made some comment, and the reporter for the Associated Press at the time said to Barbara Bush, when she was saying about how you know, unfair and unfortunate this all was, that they were getting mocked for their wealth and status, that he said, well, you're not exactly paupers. And he meant it, you know, mostly as a joke, but apparently this kind of hit a nerve. And she said something like, well, at least we're open about it. We don't try to pretend we're something we're not. We're now like that. And she was clearly referring to Geraldine Ferraro. And she used the term rhymes with which is, you know, a convenient euphemism when you want to use a bad word. The reporter went and ran with it. Obviously, this caused a kerfluffle for the Reagan-Bush campaign. You know, later in her memoir, she writes and describing how she was, you know, she basically spent 24 hours sobbing, thinking about how much she had embarrassed George H.W. Bush, embarrassed her family, embarrassed the campaign, you know, that she had, you know, said something she wasn't supposed to. By the way, isn't it kind of amazing, Greg, that even implying the B word in today's culture, like that was scandalous then, right? Now this is, you know, and you know, now we've got, you know, all kinds of off-color language permeating our culture. But you know, that so within a day or two, she called up Geraldine Ferraro, and Ferraro writes in her autobiography that you know, she didn't really like, you know, she was kind of, you know, she was pretty angry when Barbara Bush had, you know, you made the comment, but she credited her for calling her quickly and said, don't worry about it, we all say things we regret, and everybody kind of moved on from that. And somebody wrote into me saying, you know, that just feels light years away from our current political culture, and some of this is focused around Trump, but I think it goes well beyond that. I think there's been this coarseness, this nastiness, this in-your-face combativeness, and really relishing it's not incidental disrespect. It's a gleeful disrespect of anybody else who disagrees with us and gets in our way. And you know, this is a, I think a real sadness that that Bush's passing marks the end of an era. You can only imagine what the Bush family is going through, and just a you know, there are times when we get told, you know, you're just getting old and crotchety and nostalgic, and you know, things are always bad, or things never get much better or much worse. But I do think our political culture was better back then, Greg, and that Barbara Bush and the way she carried herself and the way that she could be strong but consistently classy and respectful was an indicator, or you know, with very rare exceptions, was an indicator of a better political culture than the one we have today, Greg.
Yeah, and it was still fierce then, but yeah, the lingering bitterness, and I'm sure social media and 24-hour cable channels are feeding into that. One other thing, obviously, that needs to be mentioned here, 73 years these two were married, all the way back to January of 1945, and they dated for a number of years before that. So a tremendous, tremendous love story on top of the political accomplishments of this family. So condolences to the Bush family on the passing of an amazing lady. So a busy day here on the Three Martini Lunch. Jim, fantastic as always. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next Three Martini Lunch.